thanks for talking to me on the podcast.
Oh, thank you for the invitation. My pleasure.
So you're from Category 3 Fly Company, and we'll get into the business nitty-gritty of it. But yeah, I really like your design. And that's why I kind of got into looking at the products first, but we'll talk about that. So I want to find, you're originally from the UK, right?
Yes, that's correct. I wasn't born there, but my family were from the UK, and I got an opportunity to come to New Zealand in 2001, I think it was. So being a fly fisherman, I jumped at that with open arms.
Did you grow up fishing?
Kind of, yeah. I was the sort of two sides to our family, and I had a very wealthy uncle who was a surgeon, and he and a group of other surgeons owned a beat on the test, which is a pretty well known classical chalk stream in the UK. So I learned to fish there, and was extremely lucky to have that privilege back in the day.
So where is the test? Like, just what area? Just maybe describe that to me.
It's heading towards the south coast if you went directly south of London, and there's two chalk streams there, two main ones, the Test and the Itchen, which is old Frank Sawyer country from the inventor of the pheasant tail and so forth, and George Edward Mackenzie Skews, and that, some of the great things we've seen in modern times from fly fishing originated there. And it was either from anglers who could fish there a lot, or it was from the river keepers themselves who also used to fish. And so I was very lucky to be able to go down there with my dad as a kid and learnt to fly fish, and then kind of late teens gave it all away to chase girls and drink beer as you do. The drinking side I was very successful, the ladies side not so successful, but and then returned to fishing when I happened to be living in northern Sweden some years later.
Why did you return to fishing? Well, firstly, why were you living in Sweden, and then why did you return to fishing?
I was actually living in the Canary Islands, which is where our eldest daughter was born, and my wife at that time was Swedish, and she wanted to move back home to Sweden, and we did, and having the rivers available and all that fishing available, coming from the UK where everything is privatized, it's very difficult to fish a river in the UK unless it's an invitation or you pay a lot of money for it. So having all these rivers in Sweden that were open to everybody, it just looked like gold. And I guess, yeah, I just rekindled an enthusiasm for it that was absolutely out of control. I mean, it was crazy. I started tying flies, and I would tie flies till 3 o'clock in the morning and sleep for 3 hours and go to work and come home, do the family stuff, and then sit there in my little spot, tying my flies till crazy hours of the morning. And I just became obsessed.
I don't know.
It just fascinated me, and the curiosity of, you know, why does a fish eat a fly and not eat another fly? And I mean, at that time my skill level was very, very limited too, so I was just a sponge for anything fly fishing, and you know, probably have spent, you know, 10,000 times on fly tying materials what people would spend on flies in their whole lifetime, and I still find bits here and there and that I've had for 20 years, and I'm never going to use it, so I usually try and find a good home for them these days.
So I just want to ask one question about the England rivers before I ask about Sweden. I mean, you say a lot of the flies we know now were basically invented there, or the things we use. Why do you think from that area, and why would that have an impact now? Is it just because, why do you think?
I think partially, and this comes back later on down the track with fly selection in New Zealand, but I think a part of the reason was they were gin clear chalk streams and you could sight fish. And obviously, when you're sight fishing, if the fish doesn't eat your fly, it's sort of right in your face. And you know that some component of either what you've done or your fly selection is incorrect. And so it became, I guess, partly an obsession because I was looking for the answer. And thankfully, there isn't one, which is what keeps us all going. I mean, if you just walked outside and caught 10 fish every time you went fishing, it would soon get pretty boring.
Do you how would you describe the fish? It was that rainbows, was that brown trout in England that you learned to fish on?
Initially, it was purely brown trout in those chalk streams, and unfortunately, in my humble opinion, they destroyed those by starting to release rainbow trout into the river. And in I hadn't been there for a long time, but I went and fished there maybe 5 years ago, and you put your fly in the water, and basically a rainbow trout that's just been released from a stock pen somewhere swims along and eats your fly. And to me, I mean, it's ideal for those people who get one day a year to go fishing. They've got busy schedules and they can go and catch fish, which is great. But I think you probably wouldn't get away with doing that today.
And are those brown trout, they're decimated? Are those popular, or are they still a healthy population?
I believe in some parts of the river there's still a healthy population, but the rainbow trout being more aggressive, I think, have become very dominant. And I remember back in the day we used to catch quite a lot of grayling as well,
Oh
which
yeah,
a lot of some people don't like. I love them. I think they're great. They're the most helpful fish on the planet. In that you can throw up a dry fly and they'll come and look. And if it's the wrong one, it doesn't matter because they'll keep coming and looking at everything you throw until you get the right one.
that's awesome.
Yeah,
And then you've
which
got
is
your
kind of
answer,
cool.
right? You've got your
Yeah,
answer.
exactly. And in my recent visit, sort of 5 years ago, there were no grayling there. And grayling notoriously need very healthy water conditions and things like that. I'm no fisheries biologist. I just like them.
Oh, observation. That's one thing I also want to fish grayling. I don't know why. Like, I've seen a couple of documentaries about grayling fishing, and then I think, oh, that should be awesome. But now in Sweden, you say there's a lot of water that anyone could access. How would you compare their kind of rules to New Zealand rules? Like, what's different and what's similar?
Very, very similar to the Queen's Chain applying in New Zealand to most places, and not all contrary to popular belief, but Sweden was the same. They have something there which is called allemansrätt, which basically means
Every man's
everybody's right.
right. Afrikaans,
And even massive forestry companies have to allow you access to their forests so you can go and pick berries or mushrooms or forage for food. And the same applies to their rivers. On the whole, you could just turn up and fish. And coming from my early background in the UK, where the only place I ever went fishing was my uncle's place on the Test, because that was kind of all we had, unless you wanted to fish reservoirs, which weren't my thing for whatever reason. But Sweden, all Scandinavian countries are usually pretty good about you wanting to roam around waving a stick in a piece of water.
And then I put out a couple of feelers and asked a couple of people, what would they ask you? And Dustin Habaner, who I think invented the habanero for you,
Yes, that's correct.
he told me you ended up guiding in Sweden. Like, how do you progress from like super obsessed tying flies and kind of just restarting it to guiding? Like, how does that transition happen?
We had a very small window of season in Sweden of 4 months. I mean, most stuff's frozen for most of the year. So there was a 4 month period every year where I could kind of fish my brains out, and which I did. And I was working at the time as well, cutting scrub underneath power lines. And the power line was so long, it took 7 years to cut it, and it had to be cut every 7 years. So you'd just go and
Start
start
again.
again. But I would, of course, I was out in the nature, and we camped out. There was no roads. We had to walk with our cutting equipment, our fuel, everything. So, and we'd camp for the week and then go home on a Friday. So quite often you'd be camped by a little lake or a small stream where you could fish. And to go back to your initial question, the I started taking friends fishing. People were, you know, "Oh, crikey, you go fly fishing. I'd love to learn to do that." And so I started showing friends, and then it just grew, and eventually started guiding through the summer months. I was still, you know, working with the scrub cutting through the rest of the year, but and then that progressed into people paying me to take them fishing, and I was whilst I was guiding there, they hold a world championships for fly fishing. I don't know if they do it every year or every couple of years, and that was held in Sweden, and I was lucky enough to guide the New Zealand team prior to the competition, of which one of the members of the team owned a little tackle store back in the day here in Taupo, which was called the Flying Gun Shop. And
That sounds like a cool name.
I can't remember if he invited me to come and work for him or I begged for a job. It's got a bit of a cloudy area, but anyway, in 2001, I ended up in New Zealand, which you know, it was stuff that I'd only ever dreamt about and seen photos of the fishing here. And you know, 2001, there wasn't the internet available like there is today, or maybe in very early start of it. So information was not that easy to get, but anything I saw about New Zealand that was just like, "Whoa, I gotta go there."
Before I ask about New Zealand, the fish in Sweden that you were targeting, brown, rainbow, everything, what were there?
We were mainly targeting browns, rainbows, a lot of grayling fishing, a lot of very good grayling fishing there, and Arctic char, some pike. I was never really got successful on the pike for whatever reason, but it just anything that swam basically, perch. This was kind of an interesting thing that happened in my early days of fly tying, in that you could fish on lakes through the ice in winter for trout. And if you chose your lake carefully, and drilled a pretty reasonable hole on the ice, you could actually sight fish. And so we used to drop white eggshells in the hole, which would give you a white background at the base of the lake. I mean, you were limited by depth, obviously, and everyone used to use maggots and all sorts of things, and I used to use flies, and you could lie there, and I learned a tremendous amount about fish, and especially lake fish, of course. But you know, you'd be there, and you'd have a trout swim up and stop with his nose right in front of your fly. And sometimes, if you gave it a little tweak, they'd eat it. Sometimes the tweak would put them off and they'd disappear. And sometimes the exact same fish that maybe had some random injury or marking on it, you'd see the same fish come back 10 minutes later and look at exactly the same fly, and your initial twitch might have sent him away, and on your twitch this time he eats it. So it was kind of like having an aquarium and a place to test stuff out.
So, and then your brain is just, all those cogs are just turning when he comes back and he eats it the second time. And you're like, what the hell?
Well, it was kind of the start of my commercial fly tying at the same time, because people, you'd quite often go to a lake and there'd be multiple people there, in, especially if it was a fishing club lake, they might have a special opening day and so forth. And flies were, as it turns out, pretty good at outfishing maggots.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, very. I never would have picked that at all. And then all these, the guys who were fishing through the ice by traditional Swedish methods were all of a sudden coming to me and going, what are you catching these fish on? And I'd show them a size 18 pheasant tail and they'd be blown away. You know, how can you catch something on something so small and so nondescriptive? And then people were asking me for them, so I started tying and selling, and that paid for my fly tying addiction of Hoffman capes and saddles and all that expensive stuff.
So do you think, I mean, I'm pure speculation from my side, but do you think something like a pheasant tail in winter would be more effective because there's kind of less bug life around and now they're seeing it and they recognize it as food? Or what do you think?
I think you're just coming down to the fact of you're imitating something that they're seeing all the time. You know, they're seeing small bugs, and a pheasant tail can be exactly what the fish wants it to be. It can be a mayfly nymph, a caddis nymph. It's a bug. And so I think that was the difference. Whilst they would eat, you know, spoons and other ice fishing methods, the most consistent one were flies. And and then all of a sudden, of course, I wanted to see where the boundary was of what I could catch in this winter, when I could actually see the fish and see their reaction to flies. And I guess that's probably where the start of category three came from.
Would you, how big would those holes be that you drill?
They'd be big enough for you to sit your face on it, like you would on a doctor's table when you lie down. So I'm not very good at dimensions, but I'm guessing maybe.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying. Like a massage table, like.
Yeah. So you could see, and you put a blanket over your head and that cuts out the glare, and then you get this amazing vision. Yeah.
And then if you're using a fly, how are you putting it in the water? Are you using like a check technique, or is it a hand line? Like how would you do that?
Hand line. A hand line with a little piece of split shot to sink the fly. And fishing, I don't remember exactly, but probably way heavier tippet than I would today, now knowing a little bit more about trout fishing. But and you could haul them up pretty good.
Oh yeah.
And you could catch and release too and put them back.
So now you moved to New Zealand, and are you immediately guiding, or did you transition and it?
No. I was the topo map king when I first got here. I mean, I was relatively young still, pretty fit from all my scrub cutting days. And I used to just buy topo maps and go fish it. I mean, I knew nothing about these rivers and streams. I, you know, apart from their name, there wasn't information as readily available as there is now. And you couldn't ask somebody about it, because a lot of the smaller streams, nobody knew anything about. The majority of anglers were still fishing in the topo fishery in winter and didn't really, I mean, there were guys doing it, but the backcountry was kind of unheard of. And so I used to buy a topo map and I just went to every single river or piece of water on that map until the map was complete, and then I'd buy another one. And so for my first 5 years, I was pretty much just doing recon.
And now, I mean, I've got an app on my phone here in Southland, the Topo app. I open it up, all the entry points to the rivers are marked. I mean, I rarely, I you'll park your car and maybe use another one, but I know where it is. I can probably spend the next 5 years just using those spots, you know. So that's a completely different scenario.
Oh, absolutely. There was a book around that time, and it was written by a gentleman called John Kent. And I think he did one for the North and South Island. And that was kind of helpful because it listed pretty much, not all of them, but pretty much everything that was worth fishing. And it told you how to access it. And then the rest of the information was not quite so accurate, but you could work out how to get there.
Yeah. And then did you transition into guiding then?
I had been guiding in Sweden, of course, but yes, I did.
Yeah, sorry, in New Zealand. Sorry, I mean, yeah, in New Zealand. So, yeah. And then was that your primary income?
Not to start with. I mean, anybody who's started out guiding knows how difficult an industry it is financially, and so I continued to work in the flying gun shop as well as guiding, and you kind of reach a point where you've got to do one or the other. You can no longer do both. Your requests for guiding is building, and you've got to go to your boss in the shop and say, hey man, any chance I can have Wednesday off because I've got a booking, and that screws up his roster for the shop, and so you reach a kind of point where, you know, your employer's probably not too happy with you.
and now you're tying all through. Are you selling at this stage in New Zealand?
I have flies.
Yeah, flies.
Yeah. I mean, I don't tie them anymore. We have them tied by our partners.
So, sorry, I mean, back then, were you selling flies
when you were guiding? Sorry. No, not really in the early days. I was just tying what I needed, but I started, the backcountry was what fascinated me, and sight fishing was just an incredible learning curve, as it was in the early days with the ice fishing. You know, fishing a river in New Zealand, you can make your presentation and you can see the reaction that fish has to your fly. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of information to be learned there. You know, this didn't work. Was it just because it's today, or will it work in a week's time? But the fish wanted to eat it, but something put it off eating it, or it spooked or whatever. But so there was always that learning, and I ended up towards the end of my full guiding career, I was doing somewhere in the region of 150 days a season in the backcountry, which doesn't sound a lot, but it's a fair amount of time on
boulders
with a backpack on. Yeah. And I could get all this information through my clients. I mean, they'd make a cast and it might be a bad cast and that spooked the fish. Well, that's that. But they might make a great cast and the fish swims a foot and looks at it and doesn't eat it. Okay, well, how do I make something that it swims a foot and eats every time? Fortunately, there is no answer to that. Otherwise, we'd all be really bored. But so I just started tweaking with flies, and then the selling of flies sort of took off after that and just grew and grew. And with the amount of guiding I was doing, I was probably going through about 2,000 flies a season myself, which I tied in the winter.
Oh, wow.
And then it sort of reached saturation point of people asking me for flies, but I had no time to tie them. That was kind of how the whole thing started.
So do you, when does category three start? Are you selling under another name? Like how does category three, like when you go, this is, I'm going to start a business now, this is it. Yeah.
Yeah. That was a real interesting process. That whole thing. I reached saturation point of not being able to tie what people wanted because I just didn't have time. I needed to tie my own stuff for the guiding. And I thought, my initial thought was, I'll find somebody and get these made. And then I can sell those that need selling, and I can use what doesn't sell for my guiding. So it's just going to be a great time saver in the winter, and I can enjoy the Tour de France without being interrupted by fly tying. And so that was the initial plan. And I set out trying to find a facility to tie flies. And that ain't easy, as it turns out. You'd think, yeah, no problem, a couple of emails and we're in the game. But politics plays a part in, companies tie for this company, so they don't want to tie for your company because you're in the same neighborhood or so forth. All those initial problems. And actually, I should retract what I've said slightly. It's easy to find somebody to tie flies for you, but it's very difficult to find someone who'll do good quality.
Interesting. I've got, maybe I should just pop to that question because, disclaimer, I buy flies, I do not tie flies, but I've got two friends who are also pretty obsessed with fly tying, and I asked my one buddy Brendan Frater, who's I met at the Auckland Fly Fishing Club. I asked him, like, what would you ask Sean? And a couple of these questions are around the comment you made now. So I'm gonna head to those questions. I'm gonna come back to category three and the design and everything. So
Okay.
and then to who's tying your flies, but let's pursue this comment now.
Yeah.
So what is the difference between flies that you tie and the ones that you would produce? If you're talking about quality, like, maybe just besides quality, what's the difference between flies you would tie for yourself and ones you produce?
No, nothing.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So the process goes that once you've found a partner to work with, a facility, which is in our case not, but usually it's Chiang Mai in Thailand, is the world capital for fly tying facilities. And once you've found somebody who you think can produce the quality that you require, you then send samples with tying recipes and all the information required down to. You have to send them the product code of the dubbing that you are using. So it's all very accurate. And they then send you counter samples and you go, yep, that one's fine. No, your tails are a little bit too long on this. And this goes backwards and forwards until you reach the right product. And once you've got that product, the greatest fly tyers in the world are working at these commercial facilities. I mean, it's unbelievable. You go to work and tie flies every day, and they become so good and so fast. It's mind-blowing, really. I mean, I was fast back in the day. Now, old age and bad eyes and fat fingers and all the rest of it have slowed me down, but these are the greatest fly tyers on the planet. I mean, it's
Are these guys fishing? They're not fishing.
no, they have absolutely no idea. So
Crazy.
they, yeah, and that is why the hair and copper to get that tied commercially how it should be is almost impossible because it's a very scruffy fly and they want to make it tidy.
So you tell them, like, mess it up a bit.
Yeah, mess it up and they'd come back and there'd be, one hair poking out and you'd do a diagram and say, see this one hair, we want 50 of those coming out.
And then
And
they
so
don't understand it.
yeah, and they're just like, well, we're trying to make everything as neat and tidy as possible. So there's a lot of stuff in there, but generally speaking, they don't fly fish. They don't know anything about fly fishing. It's just a production facility, essentially.
So, are there flies you wouldn't have produced? You've pretty much answered this question in a way, but are there flies you wouldn't have produced because, quality isn't an issue, is it?
No, I don't have any flies that I wouldn't produce because I don't want to give away a secret or anything like that. And when I'm the world's worst businessman, but there comes a point also where the cost of tying and the cost of the materials outweighs the possibility to make a profit, which we need to do as a business to keep functioning. It's not our main incentive, is not profit. We're not, whilst we like to make a profit, when that's not our main goal. Our main goal is to be creative and make cool stuff. But sorry, I lost my thread there. The question was...
no, it was just, I think you've answered it. Are there flies you wouldn't produce? And but no, you definitely answer that.
Yeah, oh. I don't have any secrets. There is no magical fly that'll catch every fish on the planet, which is awesome. The 101 and, is pretty close. But
the quality is so good that you feel they can beat... they can beat anyone. So there's nothing you'd say it's too good. You yourself have to tie it. You trust those guys to make
I
it.
I trust them. We are extremely lucky with our relationship with our production facility. They are extremely good at what they do. And of course you get hiccups now and then. You might get a bad batch of hooks from the supplier. It's not them who supplied them. They've come... And so you get little issues down the line, but you get that in all walks of life. And so, yeah, our relationship with them is sensational.
So let's talk about that. And I do understand you have to be a bit cryptic because of the community work going on. But how much can you say about who's tying for you? It is a group that kind of helps people in need. Like how much can you say?
Yeah, they and I didn't know this when we entered into a business relationship. I didn't know it, and they didn't tell me till some years afterwards. But they help with their recruitment of staff. Aren't always people who've come from the best backgrounds. Okay. So it's nice to be able to, you know, be a part of that too in some way, if makes sense. I mean, I'm a great believer in when it comes to business that everybody's got to be happy.
Yeah.
And for that very same reason, Dustin, whose name you brought up earlier, whose fly we produce, we pay him a royalty for that.
Yeah.
So the way I see it is it's his art.
Yeah.
And if he lets us use it, we need to compensate him for that in some ways. And I'm a great believer in every walk of business, of what goes around and comes around. You know, the first dude we ever bought cardboard boxes to ship our flies from is still the same dude we buy our cardboard boxes of, just the volume
has increased. Yeah.
And relationships are so important in life that it's nice to have a very good relationship with the facility, and I hope it goes both ways.
How did you come about that? Did you test a few guys and then found them, or how did you find them?
I actually knew about them, and I approached them straight off the bat, and politically, they wouldn't tie the flies for me. So I then eventually found another facility, and you know, we're still talking. I'm still maybe 2 years into this process, and I still do not have a fly on the table that I can sell. So this is an incredibly lengthy procedure, and we started with this. Can I digress slightly?
Yes, go. Digress as much as you want.
Somebody gave me a wonderful piece of advice when these were friends who I'd see once a year, and they knew I was starting or trying to start a fly company, and I'd see them once a year and they'd go, "Wow, how's the company going?" And I'm like, "Well, we haven't quite got there yet, but we're working on it." And somebody gave me a wonderful piece of advice was, get that thing up and running and then look at ways to make improvements. If you try and produce something that is perfect from the start, you will never open your doors.
Yes.
So I took their advice, and I had our flies produced by a facility in Sri Lanka, and they were okay, but they weren't great.
Yeah.
And some of that, me with my critical eye saying they're okay, they were okay, to most people, they'd look at it and go, wow, that's fantastic.
Yeah, but yeah.
Once you've tied a few flies, you get a feel, and you can't always put your finger on what would make that fly look better.
Yeah.
And so, yeah. And then anyway, the facility that we currently use, after a year, came back to us and said, hey, look, policies have changed, politics have changed. We can now produce your flies for you if you want. So we switched facility.
Category three, where did the name come from?
That's a cool story. That's one of my favorite stories, mainly because it involves one of my greatest friends. And I had a gentleman, or still have a gentleman, who has been fishing for probably 20 years with me, and we do usually 18 odd days a summer. He's from overseas. He comes over, and he's now 84. And this guy is a machine. I mean, if you want to go to a piece of water where you've got huge up and overs, swimming through gorges, nothing is a problem to him. And he just loves it. In fact, he doesn't really care about the fish. He's caught so many fish in his life. For him, it's the day's journey.
Yeah,
and I'd meet him in the morning, and he'd say, you know, where are we going today? And I'd tell him, and he'd go, have we got any up and overs? And I might say, no, not today, Craig. And he'd go, oh, are we swimming through any gorges? And I'd go, not today, Craig. And his face would drop, and he'd say, can we go somewhere else?
Oh, wow, that's cool.
So anyway, I had this great friend, have this great friend. And
Where is he from? Sorry, do you want to name him? Well, you don't have to, of course.
His name is Craig Barrett, and he's from the United States.
Okay, yeah.
And he lives in Montana part of the year. He does a ton of fishing. And anyway, so we're traipsing our way up backcountry rivers, as you do day after day, and we're trying to think of a name for this fly company that I'm still trying to start.
Yeah.
And we were sitting having lunch and talking about something completely different. And there's an American motivational speaker who's a mountaineer, I think, who talks about three different categories of fun. Category one, regular, normal fun. Category two, running a marathon. It's not actually fun at the time, but it's quite nice to look back on. And then category three was so much fun, you never want it to end.
Mm.
And anyway, after lunch, we were on the Repia River, which is a heavily bush-clad North Island stream, very gorgy. And we got to this section. We'd been there multiple times together, where it's, you know, a 2 or 3 minute swim up through an impassable gorge. And then anyway, so I swam through, and I'm up on this rocky ledge getting my stuff back together, and you know, everything was in waterproof bags, etc. And I look down, and there's this 80-year-old man swimming through this gorge with his wading boots on, with this huge smile on his face. And I shouted down to him, I said, you having fun down there, Craig? And he goes, category three, man, category three. And I said to him, whoa, there we go.
That's
the Category
cool.
Three Fly Company was born. So much fun, we don't want it to end.
So there's a design that you have. It's basically skeleton hands, and the one holds with the thumb and the index finger holds a C, and the other one with the thumb, well, it's with the ring finger, the middle finger, and the index finger, I think, holds a three. So that's category three. Who came up with that design?
Oh, we were so lucky. I mean, the first logo for the company I did myself, and you know, at that time, I we didn't have money to get contractors to help us with stuff we didn't know about. So, you know, the first catalog I did in an Adobe program, and I had two computers running. On one would be, how do you move that picture, you know, Adobe Illustrator? And it would tell me, and then I'd go to the other. I mean, everything just took such a long time. It was difficult. And anyway, we finally saved enough money to get somebody to do us a new logo, which we desperately needed because I'd done the initial one and it was awful. And Dan Jeans is his name, and he's got a company called Buttery Studio. He's based over in the Hawke's Bay. He's a young artist. And anyway, I contacted him and said, I need a logo. And everything that came back was your typical jumping trout or trout eating a fly or everything that's been done 1,000 times. And I said to him, no, we want something different. And he said, well, send me a bunch of your guiding photos and I'll see what I come up with. And one of the photos I sent him was myself and Craig actually in a helicopter just taking off to go fish somewhere. And I've looked down and I've seen this person's about to take a photo of us. So I've done C3 with my fingers out the window. And that was one of the photos I sent to Dan, and that was the logo he came back with.
Oh, that's cool. And then where does the work your fingers to the bones come from? Because that's like kind of like a bit of, is it your slogan or is it just on that one design?
It was just on that one design. That was just, I have this terrible habit of hearing phrases or words through everyday life and thinking, wow, that would be a great name for a fly.
Yeah.
And I'd heard or seen somebody say working your fingers to the bone. And I kind of in my mind thought, how appropriate is that for a lot of us? Not just fly fishermen, but everybody's got so little time these days to get outside and go do something. And, you know, whether it's netball, hockey, fly fish, it doesn't matter what it is. But, and then I was thinking, you know, about we're all here working our fingers to the bone to try and buy that time to go and do our Category 3 fun stuff.
That's very rock and roll.
Yeah. And that's kind of where it came from. But like, I have a little notepad on my desk, and every time I hear something on the radio or whatever, where I hear a phrase or a word that I think is kind of humorous to the fly fishing side of things, then I write it down and then try and design something that fits with that.
It makes me think, I don't know if you know the Mission Fly Mag. It's a like kind of a very like rock and roll online fly magazine out of South Africa. And they have a t-shirt design where it's a photo of a guy holding a fish, but he's on the cell phone. He's holding the cell phone. And then he just says, no, I'm busy.
Yeah. Love it.
That's kind of the same
that's
kind.
That's great. I'll have to check him out.
On Friday at like 1 p.m. last Friday, I was like, no, screw this. I can't work anymore. So I went to the Makarewa and fished. And then at the same time, someone phoned me. And I was like talking to them and feeling guilty at the same time. I think that was the same thing. So what do you have in your fly box? Is there like a confidence flyer that you just have heaps of?
Absolutely. And, you know, the 101, I don't know why that catches fish like it does.
Yeah.
I mean, it's... We have a few stores in other parts of the world that sell our products, and the 101 is always the biggest seller. And I don't know if it's because it's got big and rubber legs and all that blah blah blah, but that will pretty much catch your fish anyway.
Every time.
Yeah, not every time, which is great, but most times. and of course, from a guiding perspective, I was always looking for any edge that would help my guests have a good day. And for some guests, you know, they've caught a fish, they're happy as anything. And other people are all different. Some people want more, some don't. But anything that, or extremely tough day where you can't get anywhere near a fish, any slight help that I could get to get these customers into a fish was critical to my industry.
Continue.
And the pole position, I'd be lost without the pole position.
What's the weirdest material you've used to tie flies with, or something that you used out of desperation, perhaps?
You hear a lot of exotic stories about people procuring things from members of their family and all sorts of things, but I guess I don't really have an answer to that, but that is also because I approach it from a commercial perspective. Yeah, I look at it from a commercial point of view. So there's absolutely no point in me cutting off some hair off my dog and tying a fly with it, because if I put it into production, I need 10,000 dogs. So, you know, in the early days, yeah, I was using all sorts of stuff. I mean, for people who are tying flies and having fun with it, then a great source is a craft store. You can find stuff in there to tie flies with, and usually very inexpensive too, whether they're beads or types of materials. A craft store is like a gold mine for a fly tire.
Do you remember what the first fly was you tied?
I don't know for certain, but I would guess it would be a pheasant tail, Frank Sawyer style.
And how many flies do you think you've tied by yourself?
It's funny, I was talking to my wife about that the other night, and it would be, I would guess, somewhere in the region of 100,000.
That's insane. So well beyond the 10,000 hour mark, or...
Oh, yeah. I mean, and in the early days, I had a vision of me being a commercial fly tire.
Yeah.
And around that time, there was a guy in America called AK Best, who was a production fly tire for Orvis, and he tied all their dry flies. And I'm talking a volume that is hard to get your head around, one dude sitting there cranking these things out one by one. I mean, he would buy his dry fly capes by the boxful, and he was, I guess, an idol to me back then, in that he was so good at what he did. But the hardest part is the discipline to sit there and go, right, I need to tie 10 dozen flies today. And go through it. But yeah, it's tying flies, unless you're doing it purely for fun, is a different ball game altogether.
I don't know if this is a commercially sensitive question, but is there a figure amount of flies that you have to get past to become commercially viable, or is that too random a question?
No, not random at all. I mean, we work on a basis of, I send a fly to Mirabelle, and they come back and they say, okay, we can produce these for you. They will be X amount per fly, or per dozen flies, and always sold in dozen. And you know, I've never been one for trying to haggle or negotiate. I mean, if that's the price they need to make a profit, well, that's what they need. So that's fine. And so you can essentially... Some companies have minimums, but you could probably just order 10 dozen.
But then what I mean also is, like, do you know you have to sell 10,000 flies a month to be commercially viable, or you have to sell as a business? Like,
I see where you're coming from.
Is there a number like that, or not really?
Not really. I mean, in the early days, our livelihood was my guiding.
And then
category three was kind of a byproduct. And then the byproduct grew more and more, but selling flies is a very, very slow process. I mean, you'd think I've got this great fly, the whole world wants to buy it. Well, you've got to go to a store and convince them to give you that 50 millimeter square little box in their display. And once you've earned that or got it, you do not want to lose it. So, being out of stock is a bad issue because if they're empty long enough, another company, and quite fairly enough, will come along and say to the dude, hey, look, man, I've been coming here for a year and this box is always empty. Why don't you let me put something in it that I'll sell and make you money? Which is totally understandable. So getting those little boxes in stores, I think today we maybe have 35 stores across the world that sell our products, predominantly in New Zealand and a few in Australia, a few in America. But, in the initial days, I was battling for that one little square.
How do you convince them that someone in the store have to go and fish with it and say, see it's effective, or do they just trust your reputation? Like, how do you convince them to give you that real estate?
Mostly it was a trust of reputation, and that's how it developed. And you might get four or five flies into the store, and then if they work well, they'll sell well. So the owner of the store or the manager sees, well, hey, this company's flies are selling well. Why don't we get more of those? And you always get things that don't sell well for ages, and then they go through the roof, and stuff that goes through the roof. And then I remember years ago there was an egg pattern called an unreal egg, and this would have been maybe about 2005. And the entire North Island winter fishery, everybody said all you need is an unreal egg. And everyone was using Unreal Egg. I haven't seen one commercially available for years. So it's kind of things go in,
So would
to.
that producer just have gone out of business, or like, how,
No,
why?
they're still in business. They just don't produce that fly. I guess sales,
That's so strange.
it is
So
very strange.
is there a top secret fly that's going to hit the market?
Never, I hope. I am working on one currently that in my mind is going to be the greatest trout nymph ever made, and certainly to my eye it looks like the sexiest trout nymph I've ever produced, but I haven't actually tried it yet. But
Oh well, if that comes to, I'd like to see it. So what questions are you asking yourself about, those questions you asked in the beginning when you saw something refuse? Like, how have those questions evolved in your mind? Like, how do you look at that fly now and think about what the fish thinks? Like, because you're now well over the 10,000 hours, you've got all the experience. Like, what questions like float around in your mind?
More often than not, it's either showing them something they don't normally see or pushing the boundaries of size.
In terms
So,
of going smaller or going bigger, or how do you mean?
going bigger.
Interesting.
Yeah. And I always used to go smaller because you knew. Here, backcountry fishing, you might get two shots, you might get three, but with every shot, your chance of hooking that fish is reducing by probably 25, 30%. So sometimes the shock tactic, you put on a size 16 something or other underneath a dry fly, and the currents and the depths are all perfect for the fish to see that fly and have an opportunity to eat it, and it doesn't. Then I'm in my mind, I'm going, I've got maybe one more shot, if I'm lucky, two, or my guest, my client, has one more or two. And more often than not, something huge outside of the square completely works. And I was in the South Island recently with And I have zero South Island experience. I've done very, very limited days down there fishing. And we were having a day of extremely difficult fishing, which is fine. You get what you get, and the fun is in the walk. And we got to a fish, and I just thought, we're having too many problems with what we're doing. We have to change something. Something is not working. And the fish were very spooky and, had just been fished too, and all the rest of the stuff that we're all used to as backcountry fishermen in New Zealand. And anyway, the next fish we approached, I tied on a fly that's actually designed by Johnny Gummer, whose flies we produce, similar to Dustin. And it was one of his designs. It's called an ultra tactical, and the size 10 is probably more like a size 8 in when you compare it to other flies with the hook that it's tied on. And it's got, a 4.5 millimeter tungsten, copper tungsten bead on it.
That's
And I'm
massive.
standing there and I go, well, for the last six fish we've seen, nothing has worked. Let's try something new. And I tied on Johnny Gummer's size 10, and it became the fly of the trip. And all that was, everything in my instinct was saying, you got to go smaller, you got to go more delicate, drop your tippet down, smaller flies, et cetera, with the situation being so difficult. Whereas the answer actually was, throw a Big Mac up there and see what happens. And yeah, bingo.
You see, so after this conversation, I'm going to go onto your website and order all of these things.
Well, then I've done my job. We don't sell flies direct
No, I do know
anyway,
that actually.
but I know what you're saying. But
Yeah.
yeah, it's such a cool sport. I mean, there are so many variables, and it just keeps it interesting and exciting. And those hot summer days in February, if you manage to get out and strike it lucky enough, and you throw out a big dry fly, and you've got fish swimming 25 feet to eat it because they've heard the plop. Well, that's kind of cool for the first fish, but after that, I mean, it's pretty boring.
Yeah, see, the thing is also that that's where experience counts, because I've really only been fly fishing for 5 years and spent basically two of that in lockdown in Auckland. So for me, I think the first 15 plops will still be cool.
And for most people, as we alluded to earlier, there's not enough hours in the day to get out and enjoy doing something that you really love to do.
What are the challenges that the industry are facing that you think are coming up?
I think the industry, it is an extremely challenging industry in that more often than not, you need to order stock a year and a half before you need it. So you're automatically looking into a crystal ball, how many of this fly in this size do I need next year? And looking at what I've sold this year, and I need to know that information or guess that information a year and a half before I need the stock in the warehouse. So just by nature, it's a difficult industry, and you're dealing with a large amount of SKUs of, it's a tough game, and it's extremely good fun. But it's not easy. And on the whole, the industry is it's like most industries. There's some very cutthroat operators, and you go to a tackle store in West Yellowstone where there's nine tackle stores in a population of, 120 people. They get that much tourist traffic in the summer. And you go into a tackle store and you go, I'd like to buy a Winston rod. And the guy will go, oh, we don't do Winston, but Pete down the road, he's got a store there. It's called such and such. Go and see him. He'll kick you out. And everybody sort of works together. Whereas you don't see that from everybody who partakes in the industry. And there's people copying other people's flies and all that sort of carry on. And you know, something like an Adams or a pheasant tail that have been around for 100 years, that's fine, you know, because everything is essentially a variant of something.
Mm.
You know, you might change a color slightly or a method, but everything is a variant of something. So, you know, we like to produce our own stuff.
Mm.
You know, we could, from a commercial point of view, if we went into doing woolly buggers and parachute atoms, and from a business perspective, that would be great. But we're having too much fun with what we're doing to want to dilute ourselves, if that makes sense.
Yeah, into,
you know, I'd love to do saltwater flies because I love saltwater fly fishing, and I won't have to then tie them myself. But but what do I know about saltwater flies? Nothing.
Yeah.
Or virtually nothing. So I'm trying to keep the company to as a core of what we know and what we do. If am I making sense?
Yeah, definitely. I think even as a freelancer myself, you have to make choices what kind of work you take.
Yeah.
And something could bring you in more money, but it could be soulless. So you choose not to do it and people think you're stupid. But really you make the choice to have your own company because you're in it for the soul, you know? You want the money also, but your priority isn't the money. It's like a constant balance that you have to play between those.
Yeah, it's getting that balance, and poverty is a great motivator, of course.
It is, for sure. That's crazy.
But, you know, I mean, to go back to your question, the one thing that I do dislike is companies copying other people's flies. Mm. I mean, you might have a fly tire. We're not big enough here in New Zealand, but in the United States, you might get a top-notch fly tire like Andrew Grillo's. He makes his living from royalties.
Mm.
That's his livelihood.
Yeah.
And he designs new flies to increase his royalty payments.
Yeah.
And so for someone else to then copy a product of his and essentially take food off his table, I find, you know, a little disheartening, but I wouldn't want to end this conversation on a bad note.
Yeah. Well, then on that note, what are you looking forward to? Anything? Next trip, next fly, business? Like, what are you looking forward to?
I look forward to everything with a passion that's to do with Category 3. We've got some new patterns in the pipeline, which will be exciting. And excuse me. But I'm going to see my dad in England in June, which is awesome. I have my granddaughter coming here in a month's time, who I've never seen before. So that's going to be great. She lives in Australia. And then from a fishing perspective, I'm going to St. Brandon's in September.
That is, I don't know, St. Brandon's.
It's a tiny atoll off the coast of Mauritius. It's 28 to 32 hours in a little skiff.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah.
I find the things that get me inspired is always the things I look forward to. I'm off to South Africa next week. And there's going to be 2 days where I have a chance to tiger fish. And last time we were basically trawling, and this time I'm taking a fly rod and I'll see if I can catch a tiger fish, and really looking forward to it. And that, yeah, all those highlights are cool. But Sean, I really love this talk. I actually have a million more questions, but thanks for chatting to me. I really like that, and really love the company. And whenever, you know, when you get a cap and then after all that wear, you get like a sweatband on it, you can't even wash it out anymore. Every time I get that sweatband, I just order a new Category 3 cap. So you've got a client for life.
Well, thank you so much for that. And thank you for your time too. I really appreciate you listening to my rant of something that's so passionate and exciting for me that may not be as exciting for other people.
It's infectious. Thanks, Sean.
Thank you.